question.
How can we use our emotions positively on our spiritual path?
How can we use our emotions positively on our spiritual path? If you look at the practice of what's called devotional yoga or bhakti yoga in Hindi, devotional yoga, you will see that you, for example, if your relationship is to, say, Christ, you could take a picture of Jesus and then think about the qualities of his life and the qualities of his compassion and the qualities of his beauty of being and the qualities of his reminding people about God. And you could look at that being and it would generate in you, if you allow it, emotional responses. These emotional responses are relational. They are warm human responses of love, of caring, of tenderness. Then if you stay with that picture of Jesus and keep being with Jesus, you will go beyond those into a deeper way of being with him, of just being with him in the presence sense. And that presence includes more and more of all of what is, all emotions all at once. But you go through the emotional doorway. You use your emotional heart as a vehicle to getting into that deeper way of being with God. Okay, that's one way. The other kinds of emotions that are generated, emotions like anger, sadness, joy, all of them, a whole range of them. What one cultivates is a spaciousness or an awareness that allows you to acknowledge the feelings, and it comes back to the word appreciating again. Acknowledge the feelings and allow them and see them as part of the human condition. They're all generated. They're like thought. They're subtle thought forms. Emotions are really subtle thought forms. And they all arise in response to something. They're reactions that come. If somebody goes like that, you have a certain emotional response. If they go like that, you have a different response. If they go like that, you have a different response. And you can feel how reactive your emotions are to situations. They're all part of a lawful, reactive domain that you keep cultivating a quietness in yourself that just watches these things coming and going and arising and passing away. And you learn not to act out your emotions, but just to appreciate and allow them. That's part of the way in which you use them spiritually. Spiritually, you don't act out your emotions. You just acknowledge them. You don't deny them, though. You don't push them down. You acknowledge that I'm angry, but you don't have to say, hey, I'm angry. That's different. But you acknowledge it. You don't deny it. That's the key thing. So the way you would use emotions is in devotional practices, you aim them towards God. And for the other kinds of emotional realms, you witness them and you sit with them and you watch them change and come and go and don't deny them and allow them, because that's part of your human condition. You know, when we talk about service, you will see how we deal with suffering. And you'll see that it awakens intense emotions and your heart is breaking and you have to let your heart break. But you've cultivated another plane of reality, which is one that notices and allows it. A quality of equanimity that lies with it. So emotions work best when you also have another plane that is not emotional going simultaneously with it, actually. Because just getting lost in your emotional reactivity just digs your hole deeper of karma. You know. But allowing your humanity, that's really part of it. Allowing your humanity. Yes. It's a very, it's an interesting and delicate line to acknowledge that you feel, say, somebody says something and it hurts you. And then you feel hurt. To acknowledge that you feel hurt, the question is, they did what they did because that's their problem. You reacted the way you reacted because that's the way you reacted. That's your problem. Right. To interpret that your feeling is their problem is when you start to feel you have to tell them that you were hurt by what they said. The other thing is, if I'm hurt by what you say, that's something for me to work with. I acknowledge it and then I work with it. I don't have to get them to not do the thing, because they're just being like a tree. They're just phenomena happening. This is not psychological, relational stuff we're talking about. We're talking about spiritual stuff now. We're talking about how you get out from under it, not how you keep digging it deeper. Do you understand? And most people don't want to hear this. I mean, I'm playing on thin ice now because I'm an old psychologist and I used to wallow in this stuff. So I'm really telling you that if you get me mad, that's my problem. And that changes relationships, as we will see when we get to the relationship group. Okay. We'll leave it now for the relationship group, because that'll come up a lot in the relationship group. I'm absolutely sure about it. Okay, let's go on. Next one.
Next question is about anger. When your guru told you to drop anger, what did this mean? And is it something we all need to do?
The question is about anger. How do you deal with anger? And when my guru said, give up anger, how to interpret that? Now, anger usually is intimately related to righteousness. You'll notice that when you get angry at somebody, it is because you feel you have been wronged and you have a sense of right. Right? And it is said in the spiritual literature that righteousness and being right is one of the last gates to the inner temple. It's one of the last obstacles to getting in the inner temple. And that one of the problems of spiritual work is ending up being a good yogi. You are a really good yogi. You know all the shlokas, you know all the positions, you do it all perfectly right. And you are really righteous and good, but you're not free. And it's called the golden chain, the chain of righteousness. And you certainly see that in most religious traditions, that the priest class gets very caught in being good, in being right. And freedom lies behind good and evil. It lies behind right and wrong. It's the one that lies behind the two. It goes behind all polarities. When you want to become free, then your righteousness and your anger are much less interesting than they used to be. You less feel comfortable just sitting in your righteousness than you do in throwing it back into the pot in order to become free. And what my guru was saying to me was, become free. Let go. And he wasn't saying, work it out. He was just saying, let it go. Now, when I was angry at all those people at the temple, I was right about every one of them. I mean, there was no doubt about it. They were irresponsible, sloppy. I had a reason for every one of the 34 people that I was angry at, 30-some-odd people. They were all inadequate to the situation. And he said to me, let go. He said, I told you to love everyone, And I said, yes, but you told me to tell the truth, and the truth is I don't love everyone. And he said, love everyone and tell the truth. Now, that's interesting. Because that's like, it's putting two things together that don't go together. But they don't go together from where I'm standing. So what he was saying to me was, when you finish standing where you think you are, in which they don't go together, you will end up standing in a place where they go together, right? Where the truth is you love everyone. And that was incomprehensible to me, because I looked over and I hated all these people. But as I looked at them with his words in my heart and mind, I looked and I saw that I hated their actions, but right behind that, if I just shifted my gaze just a little bit, they were all souls caught in their own stuff, which led them, their fears, which led them to do thises and thats, and led me to do thises and thats in judgment. And right behind it were these beautiful, pristine souls that I loved very dearly. And so I flicked my gaze, and I looked and I saw that I loved them. And I was angry at actions, but not at beings. I also saw that anger is divisive. Anger keeps, when you're angry, you push against something. When you push against something, it separates you. It defines what isn't you. And yet I understood that where I'm going to is a place which embraces the universe and experiences the unity of all things. So that every time I held on to anger, even if I was right, I ended up cutting myself off. And I had lived years and years with a heart that was closed and tight and cut off. And I could feel it affecting my body. It affected everything about my life. I was so alienated from life by my anger and my righteousness and my judgment, which came out of my own sense of inadequacy. Can you hear that issue? It may be familiar to some of you. And what I then realized was that it was too painful to be right. It was costing me more than it was worth. And that I wanted to be part of the flow of the universe rather than to be sitting in judgment of it. And that the anger was not going to get me to God. I heard what he was saying. And he said, give up a little anger each day and I'll help you. And I started to respond that when anger arose, instead of cultivating it and, you know, fertilizing it and watering it and feeding it, I just said, the hell with it. It's not going to get me where I really want to go. It's a way station along the way, but it's not going to get me there. And even though I'm right, I'm going to give it up. Because I looked and I saw in, as we'll see in politics, which we're going to discuss in a few minutes, I saw in politics the way in which anger was divisive and it polarized people. And I saw that you had to be able to oppose people without anger. And that anger was not necessarily a functional commodity. And that I could just let it go. And it was hard because there was pride involved. Because I was right. And he didn't say work it out. He didn't say sit down and you say, well, I was a little wrong. And you say, well, I was a little wrong. And then everybody feels better. That wasn't what he said. He said, give it up. He didn't say work it out. And I realized that went counter to my whole psychological training. But I decided that I wanted to be free, and I just give it up. And it's been very difficult, extremely difficult, because often the people that I am angry at are, I'm really right. You know? And then I realize that I am not free, and I want to be free. And so I let it go. And if they've done stuff that is inappropriate, that's their problem. My job is to keep my heart open, because if my heart is open, they can change that much faster. I don't have to sit in judgment. I don't have to play God with everybody around me. And so I have practiced letting my anger go. And I would say that I have about 1/10 of the anger I had 15 years ago. I was a very angry person, very judgmental and very angry, and held grudges. And I would say I don't have those anymore. I think there are maybe a couple of people that I have stuff to work out with at this moment, that I have stuff where I'm holding something. And it's very painful to me, and I see that I have to let it go. People that I've worked very closely with, where I feel that I've gotten caught in my own judging mind. That's my problem, and I've got some work to do. I don't see it as something what I'm right any longer. I just see it as a problem. Okay. I can see. But just take a couple of questions and go on. Yes. Now, there is an anger that comes that's called dharmic anger. That the only kind of anger that is appropriate is when you love another person so much that the anger is come as a device for liberating them out of your love. If you're identified with your anger, forget it. You've got to assume his love for all these people was so intense that he was doing that as a teaching, and that was all part of the storyline. You know? Because if he hadn't done that, the rest of the story wouldn't have happened. I mean, that's the part of it that's always tricky, you know, because you want to make it into a melodrama. But, I mean, Christ needed Judas just as, you know, I mean, everybody was necessary for the story. Excuse me. Yes. Yeah, well, anger, you've got to watch that anger comes out of judgment. And you can say that something is inappropriate and do something to stop it. The question is whether the anger is a correlate that's useful or not. And it is only useful, I think, when it is rooted in love and equanimity. When the anger is an intentional emotional response that you use as a teaching device out of your love and equanimity. When you're caught in it, I do not think it's divisive. All right? That's a strong way of saying that. Yeah, last one. About what? Dharmic anger. That's what I just said again. Anger that comes out of love and equanimity. When I love you so much, like in Tibetan Buddhism, there are stories of the guru who keeps beating the student and keeps frustrating him and being very angry and irritable. And actually, that wasn't the guru at all. That was merely a functional behavior that came out of the love and the wanting to liberate the other person. Right? It wasn't coming out of any real anger in the person. There was no hatred in it. The anger came out of compassion, came out of love. To liberate the other person from whatever they were stuck in. But that's a very delicate relationship. That's very rare that one is in that role to do that. Right? I mean, you can be as angry as you want, as long as you love enough. Because if you love enough, the anger is a very different kind of anger. I mean, there are times when you act strongly. Like when you study parent-child relationships, you will see that when the love between the child and the parent is strong enough, the parent can use anger. The anger can arise, and it doesn't threaten the love. It comes out of such intense love. On the other hand, there are other kinds of parent-child relationships where the parent gets so lost in their anger that the love is lost. That has an entirely different effect on the child. Then the child feels very insecure. The other way, because we used to do studies to determine whether spanking a child affected their development. Turned out spanking isn't a variable that makes any difference at all. It depends on whether you spank with love or you spank with withdrawal of love. You can hear that. Next question.
Ramdas.
Yes.
We're going to start with fear.
Fear.
Fear, yes. And we're quite a frightened group, so we'd like the support of everybody to be courageous enough to ask our questions. Emmanuel says that fear is the only issue, and it became apparent for all of us in our group that we'd spent our whole life in a reactive dance of fear. And when we examined that, we realized that very often the thing we were frightened of wasn't nearly as frightening as the fear, and that it became the fear of the fear of the fear. And We wanted to try to understand what the fear is, what the thing is that we're so frightened of, and whether that energy is something that we can transform. Is it our friend? Is it our foe? And how practically can we deal with it as well as understanding it?
Okay. Well, well presented for a frightened person. Fear is the result of getting, is getting caught in the middle. Buddha says it's the result of ignorance, and the ignorance is that when you start out as an infant with an undifferentiated awareness, and then you are taught who you are, that component, that structure, which we call ego, is a very fragile structure. It seems tough, but it's actually a very fragile structure, and it's a structure that is neural patterns, if you will, and it has on one side of it what Freud referred to as the id, or the impulse life, which the structure is designed to interface between the impulse life and the society, to protect the society from the impulse life. And on the other hand, it is this fragile structure in the face of tremendous forces externally, which are parents and then social institutions and chaos and storms and nature, all of it. So when you didn't have a framework, when you didn't have a somebody-ness, you are just part of the universe and there's no fear. I mean, a tree isn't frightened and it's not clear. I mean, even like in one of the discussions that Emmanuel had about what a mouse feels like when it's being eaten by a cat, the question is the mouse saying, "Oh my God, I'm being eaten by a cat"? Or is it feeling warmth and moisture and shifts in energy? And is the squealing, do we project, we anthropomorphize and we say it's squealing because it's afraid. But to be afraid, one has to have a self-concept. And when an organism is functioning instinctually in a scene, each change in the homeostasis, each change in the balance of the situation is just a new moment. It's just a new moment to which it responds. For example, we'll stay away from that one. it's very delicate to interpret things because we tend to interpret in terms of where we're sitting, and we've developed these structures. And if you can sense the way that works, just see on one side of you these extremely powerful impulses in you that you're afraid of, and on the other side the tremendous forces outside that you're afraid of, and feeling yourself as a very fragile entity within that structure. And so that the root of the fear is the separateness. The root of the fear is the model one has of oneself. That's where the fear starts. Once that exists, then you process everything from inside or outside in terms of that model. And it keeps reinforcing the feeling of vulnerability because, in fact, there are externally incredibly powerful forces outside and inside. The transformative process of spiritual work is reawakening to the innocence of going behind that model that one had that cut oneself off, that made oneself a tiny little fragile somebody. And a lot of the power preoccupations that we end up having and the especially the power of trying to leave something behind in the face of death, is the feeling of our own fragility. And if you look at social structures, you see how much social institution is based upon the feeling of fragility of the human condition. So, how you deal with fear, because you say, I'm afraid of that person. I mean, you say, I'm afraid of being socially shamed. But when you are socially shamed, it hurts, and then here we still are. You're afraid of violence, and then if violence happens, sure, it's scary and painful, and then behind it, here we are. And I think you presented it right, that often the fear feeds upon itself, and we're almost afraid of the fear, or the fear is the thing rather than what we're afraid of. We're just afraid. We're just afraid. We just feel very vulnerable. The ways of dealing with it, see, in a therapeutics tradition, what you usually do is try to figure out what you're afraid of. Another technique is this witness, which merely sits with the fear and tries to get it before it becomes so consuming that there's no space left. There's usually a little space left. The image I usually use is if you have a picture frame, you got a painting of a cloud, of a gray cloud against a blue sky, but you only had one picture frame and it was a little too small. So what you did was you bent the canvas around to frame it. But in doing so, you lost all the blue sky. So you ended up with just a framed gray. Right? It fills the entire frame. So when you look around, you say, I'm afraid, or I'm depressed, or something. If you added enlarged the frame so there was a little, even just a little bit of that kind of round thing of a cloud and a little blue space, you'd say, ah, a cloud. Right? That's what the witness is. The witness is that tiny little blue over in the corner that leads you to say, ah, fear. I've talked about the woman calling me in the middle of the night many years ago. And she said, I've taken LSD and I'm going to commit suicide. And I'm going crazy. I've gone crazy. I'm going to commit suicide. She called me from California to New York State at 2 in the morning. So I got up and I said, yes, okay, you're going to commit suicide and you're crazy. And it's dawned on me, I said to her, look, you're obviously too mad to talk to. Could I speak to whoever it was that picked up the phone and dialed 7 numbers plus an area code to get me? Because whoever that is obviously got all their marbles, and I'd like to talk to that person, see? See? And in a way, that's the witness of the rest of it, see? Like, I'll dial him and tell him I'm mad, you know? It's like, and in a way, that's the little blue sky, and that's what we have in us all the time. Often we get so frightened, we can't stop for a moment to notice, ah, there's fear, because it's consumed us. So the art is to keep cultivating that witness, continuously cultivating it in all the opportunities you have, so that it is present more and more of the time. At first it's there about 1% of the time, and all the rest of it's there 90%, 99% of the time. But over a while it gets so that it's there almost 50% of the time. And then as you start to go into these things, ah, here comes fear. Ah, here comes depression again. And when you focus on the witness rather than on the fear, you see that there's a part of you that is not afraid, that's just noticing it. The noticer isn't judging it. It's not trying to change it. It's not even afraid. It's just noticing. Like somebody comes in and says, I'm depressed. I said, are you completely depressed? Yes, I'm completely depressed. You're absolutely sure you're completely depressed, yes. At this moment, as you're telling me you're depressed, are you depressed? Well, no, I'm just telling you I'm depressed. That's the one, right there. That's the one. So in a way, recognizing that there is a part of you that always exists that is not afraid. And in the deeper mystical sense or transformative or spiritual sense, there is indeed a part of you that is always not afraid. Because there is a part of you that was never separate. And that part of you that was never separate, well, how could you be afraid? You are everything. What could you be afraid of? It's all it is transformation of energy. I recall once being, again, I'm sorry that so many psychedelic stories are coming out this week. It must be somebody I'm trying to really do it to. But I was in Mexico in the ocean for an all-night LSD session, and there was a very wild surf, and I realized that if I went forward into the surf, since I couldn't tell the difference between up and down, I probably would drown. And I stood there and feeling all these forces upon me, and then I got this experience of going, of imagining going into the surf and being underwater, and then that feeling of drowning, and then shifting, and then a whole new balance in relation to nature. And then I'm a bit of floating something on the water, and everything changes, and then there's moments in other people's minds when they say, oh, Richard, remember him? He died in the ocean in Mexico, and there's all these little flickers, and then everything quiets down, and then there's a new balance in the universe. And it was just a little shift from that balance into that one. In one, I am this somebody doing something, and in the next, I am part of the ocean's stuff, like a piece of seaweed. And my consciousness has moved into some other plane. And it all was, once I got out of the anxiety about it, it was just a shift, a metamorphosis of balance. It's just like a tree falling and then rotting and then providing nurturance for everything else in the forest and going on. And the tree isn't upset about its change of state. And I began to see there's the process of death, of the just seeing transformation of energy. And the deepest fear, of course, is the death, which is the extinction of that fragile little thing that we created in the first place. Because once you get back into the mystical root being, your true self, it doesn't die, because it wasn't born. It just is. So there's always a place that is not afraid, and that's what one works to find in oneself, by that work on oneself. And that's different, because if you are afraid because of that vulnerability and you keep focusing on what you're afraid of, like I'm afraid of heights, or I'm afraid of violence in the streets, or I'm afraid of this, you will keep substituting one after another. As you get rid of one, there'll be a whole new one to play with. Because it isn't really, you just pick one and then focus on it, but that isn't really what it's about. It's the fear itself from where you're standing. It's not the object, it's the subject that's the dealing with. Questions?
It's interesting because as I sit here waiting to ask the question, I see that part of myself that is invested in the question. And at the same time, a part of myself that is not.
Right.
And
we'll meet in both of those places. Okay. I won't take you seriously.
Well, I'm reminded of one of your talks in which you said during the question and answer period that we would pretend we had questions and you would pretend that you had answers.
Right.
So in that vein, my question is, when I'm quiet and when I'm still, as in meditation, I'm aware of the fear and the vulnerability that lies behind the contraction of my ego or the closing down. But many times I experience this fear as a heaviness or a stuckness, tightness, or as anger. Now, you've spoken at length about the anger that you worked with when with Maharishi, and also the anger at pushing away your father. How do we work with the fear which underlies the contraction into stuckness or heaviness or anger?
If you design your life to keep tasting those mindful moments, the moments of spaciousness, after some time, as you contract, you feel the thickness and the unsatisfactoriness of the state. You don't even know why you've contracted. See, the tendency is when you contract to say, why did I contract? Was I angry? Was I tired? What was it? But you get to the point where you just treat the contraction or the kind of tightening or the closing down of the heart, you just treat it as what it is, and you immediately go into whatever method you have. See, that's why I hold these beads all the time. I mean, you must see me with these beads almost all the time. Now, a lot of the time, they're just completely unconscious. But when I start to feel heavy, I feel the beads in my finger now. I note the heaviness. The noting is the heaviness. And then instead of figuring out why am I heavy, which is just going to feed the whole issue, I know that that is not necessary to be in that state, that I've closed down. And I just want to come back into spaciousness. And then it's Ram, Ram, Ram. And it's my guru going Ram, 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 Ram. And it's when you've invested in your method, because you know your method brings you out of those places, then you call upon your method at that moment, and you get so that it's an automatic process. It's almost automatic. It's mediated by one thought. It's I'm stuck, and then the next thing is Ram. It's interesting because I sleep often with my beads in my hand, and I will awake out of a dream, and I'm still in the dream, and I can feel the thickness of the dream. And I'll just feel the bead. The bead, the sensory input of the bead starts the Ram. And then I can feel the moment where the Ram is the spaciousness and the dream is the contraction. And I'm right there and I can feel there's a pull to stay in the contraction. And then the deeper commitment to being free asserts itself. And I realized, because holding on to the contraction has a whole psychological thing around it of righteousness, of continuity, of that you don't have any right to be joyful. I mean, it feeds so many psychological things. But once you've made the commitment that I want to be free, you got to have made that commitment deeply enough so that at those moments you don't have to make it all over again. You've already made it. So the two commitments are, I want to let go of that thickness, and the other is, I have faith in my method. And you have faith in the method when the method's worked often enough. Right? So I'll either use my beads or I'll bring Maharaji to mind. And I'll see him giggling at me, saying, stuck again, eh? You know, and he's sort of giggling. And then I just, these just loosen it. How hard it is to loosen it depends on how deep in you got. And what happens is, as you keep doing your practices, you catch these things sooner. You catch them as you start to go into them, rather than after you're deep in. Like, I can start to talk to somebody, And I started from a very spacious point, and then I can feel my mind thickening as I get into wanting them to understand something. And I realize I'm losing it. And then at that moment, I just either stop or start to do the beads while I'm talking, or all my little techniques work. I just keep working to loosen it, to remind me. Okay?
Is a judgmental mind ever appropriate, and isn't it usually motivated by fear?
A judgmental mind is usually motivated by fear. Discriminating mind is comes out of wisdom. To see the difference between things is wisdom. To get attached to preferences about it is comes out of fear, which comes out of separateness. The judging mind usually has a root in one's own feeling of not enoughness. Now, judging of this is better than that, like this quiche is better than that quiche or something like that, it all depends, again, on where the attachment is inside the consciousness regarding it. That's more discriminating between things. The kinds of judging we're dealing with that is the problem is the judging about human beings. That's where the problem arises. And the other part of the problem is getting stuck in the judging mind. Getting stuck in the mind which is constantly judging and having preferences. Because it clouds your ability to see just what is without preferring this or that. Feelings lead to preferences. That whole law of dependent origination is where the root problem is that keeps karma going, that you prefer this over that, down to the root thing of preferring life over death. And judging things that take you away from life until finally you just see this leads to this, this leads to that, and you understand how it all works. And you can say, if I have a choice, I would take this, but if I don't have it, there's no clinging. I let go right away. So, but the kind of judging we're talking about most of the time is rooted in fear, yeah. Yes.
How can I judge myself less harshly and appreciate myself more?
I think that part of it is observing oneself more impersonally. I often use this image, which I've used already, I think, but let me say it again. That when you go out in the woods and you look at trees, you see all these different trees, and some of them are bent, and some of them are straight, and some of them are evergreens, and some of them are, you know, whatever. And you look at the tree, and you just, you allow it, you appreciate it. You see why it is the way it is, you sort of understand that it didn't get enough light, and so it turned that way. And you don't get all emotional about it. You just allow it. You appreciate the tree. The minute you get near humans, you lose all that. And you're constantly saying, you're to this, or I'm to this, or that judging mind comes in. And so I practice turning people into trees, which means appreciating them just the way they are. And there was a period of time where I used to have a picture of myself on my puja table. Later I had Caspar Weinberger, but earlier on I had me. And people would come and say, my God, what an ego this guy's got. He's got his own picture on his puja table.